Hi, and welcome again to the China Startup Pulse. I'm Ryan Chukin with
Todd Embley,
and we're here to bring you a cutting-edge perspective on the startup scene in China.
Mm-hmm.
Today, we have an amazing guest.
Yes, longtime friend, mentor of China Accelerator. He's been in China for a long time. He came in with Silicon Valley Bank. Now he's parted ways with Silicon Valley Bank, kind of, and is now with Red Lion Capital. So he has a lot of experience and a lot of perspective on China and what's going on here.
Mm-hmm. His name, Armin Zan.
Mm-hmm.
He also tells us about how to size up the Chinese investment community right now. Mm-hmm. You know, are things growing? Are things shrinking? Is it a good opportunity for startups early phase or for later phase investments?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we get into internet banks. We talk about, you know, is winter coming for trying to raise capital, not only in China, but, you know, we know it's on the horizon. A lot of people talking about it around the world. And he's got some advice, got some pro tips for those that are you know, in startups, raising money, coming to China, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so I'd say this is the investment episode.
It is. This is very much the investment episode. We've needed to do one like this. So happy to have Armin, who's just as knowledgeable as it comes.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's get on into it.
All right, sounds good. Hope you enjoy. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the China Startup Pulse. My name is Todd Embley. I am here with usual as my co-host, Ryan. Say hi, Ryan.
Hi, Ryan.
I knew you would say that. Yeah, it was right there. And we are here today with our good friend, mentor at China Accelerator.
An amazing
Armin
mentor.
Armin Zand, founder of Red Lion Capital. Armin, say hello.
Very glad to be here, and hello.
Yes. See, he went the other way with that. He did not just repeat what I said to say.
It's because he doesn't know you.
He's smart. He's smarter than us.
I know.
So he does that. Armin, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for coming in. Really appreciate it. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you ended up here in China?
In China? Okay. Yeah. Very good. I've been in China now since 2008. I came out here with Silicon Valley Bank. It's my fourth country with SVB. I've been to India, I've been to Israel, the UK, and most recently China. I came out here as an expat to help set up Silicon Valley Bank's China presence. In 2012, we started a joint venture with Shanghai Pudong Development Bank. And the objective was always that we wanted to provide financial services and banking for the tech and entrepreneurial ecosystem, which in the U.S., that's what Silicon Valley Bank is known for. Mm-hmm. And in China, it's relatively new. And so that was what brought me out here.
Okay. And so, and your role with Silicon Valley Bank when you came out here was exactly what?
Since when I came out here, we weren't really doing much. So in terms of real banking services, because we didn't have a license. So I was doing a lot of business development, and I was building the relationships with the venture capital firms so that could help us get into the banking business once we got our license. And we started to do some one-off transactions to see what it was like to do typical venture lending here in China. So more business development than anything else.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, and sorry, Ryan, I'm going to let you talk, I swear to God. but I just have a couple questions.
Yeah.
What I thought was pretty interesting was, and we'll talk about Red Lion mostly here, and as well as other things, but Silicon Valley Bank, in order to enter China, and the partner with what was it, Shanghai Pudong Development Bank.
That's right.
Right? Now, there's some interest. That had to happen. You couldn't just enter China, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
We were told on day one that if we wanted to get a banking license and compete on a level playing field, that it was almost impossible for us to do it alone, and much more likely if we had a local partner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you had to keep your nose clean for, what was it, like 3 years or something like that, right? You had some restrictions for a while, didn't you?
Right, right. So in the first 3 years, the local banking regulators required Silicon Valley Bank to operate only in foreign currency, which is a huge stumbling block if you really want to provide services to the local community. And once you were able to do that profitably and with your nose clean, then they let you operate in local renminbi, which just started this year in July, actually.
Wow. What's that sell like to your partners back in Silicon Valley who don't understand that this is all this is everything that you need to do to get through.
Yeah, they on one hand, I think they understand that the Chinese government has a lot of restrictions and they don't just let you drop in and do business and compete with the local banks. On the other hand, they just thought it was ridiculous because, you know, what's the point of banking in China if you're going to do it in foreign currency?
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, for a long time, there was a lot of question marks if that was ever going to happen. And it did in July, right on time, after our kind of 3-year you know, penalty box
probation,
and probation.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And now the bank is fully running in local currency.
Okay. And so, you know, the podcast again, you know, just to remind everybody, I mean, it's for everybody who's interested in startups, and what's going on in the ecosystem here in China, whether you're in China and you're new to the ecosystem and you're looking at getting involved in it here, or you're outside China,
yeah,
which we think a lot of listeners are going to be looking at doing startups, and they see the big bad economy of China. They think, gosh, you know, maybe we should just, mm-hmm, you know, go over and do it there. We've done a startup. We've done pretty well here. Now we're looking at our second or third market. Maybe we should enter China, and people who want to know what's going on here. Now, Silicon Valley Bank was in Silicon Valley and a lot of other places because you were previously bouncing around a little bit. How did that conversation go, you know, when the topic of China came up? I mean, why was it interesting, and kind of what pushed you guys over the edge to make the move to come out here? Because it's obviously littered with a lot of,
yeah,
you know, carcasses along the way to the path to get into China. So how did that go?
Were yeah. You- yeah. So the bank has been active in China since 1998, I think. In that early on, we were sending people across the fly-in model, mm-hmm, and coming to China and building relationships and getting to know the market. In the early part of 2000, we started actually making LP investments in funds, mm-hmm, which I still to this day believe was one of the most important things that you did, because if you make small investments into funds, you get such a nice picture and overview of what's going on in the marketplace, and you also get access to a lot of deals, obviously. Mm-hmm. And so Silicon Valley Bank did make a lot of investments into funds, and then we also helped bring in venture capital firms from the Valley. And when I mean this literally. Silicon Valley Bank actually put John Doerr on a plane and brought him to China, except it was his own plane. It's true.
Put him on his plane.
Yeah. It put him on his plane and brought him to China in 05. And the plan at that point was give Valley investors a clue into what's going on here. And the result of that was two things. One is a lot of those firms that we helped bring over actually did set up operations in China. And the rest decided that they were going to either partner or they were going to find another avenue into doing business in China. And so I can't say that Silicon Valley Bank takes credit for bringing, you know, what the market is today to China, but it definitely played a leading role in doing that. Mm-hmm. And so back to your question, you know, what was that conversation like? It was always that Silicon Valley Bank was going to go global, and that's why we went to places like India, Israel, UK, and China. And we always knew that China was the biggest yet most complex opportunity, and that to make it happen, we're going to have to go big or go home. And that was where the banking license effort came from.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, I mean, now you wouldn't need to put John on his own plane. So you could just actually hand him a link or a URL to the China, mm-hmm, Startup Pulse. And he would then be fully aware of what's going on.
Absolutely. That's right.
Okay, so you came over, and so getting into China, building relationships, doing the partnership thing, that was one, you know, struggle. Now you actually have to look for customers and you have to start dealing with customers. So that's just a big question in and, mm-hmm, of itself, but can you talk a little bit about...
Was it easier in the very beginning, or is it harder now? The market's a little bit more mature. Like, what was that like in the first place, and then how has that changed,
I think? Silicon Valley Bank has a great brand, and even if you translate that directly into Chinese, it's great. Guigu Yinghong just means Silicon Valley Bank. Silicon Valley... in any language itself has great meaning.
Yeah.
And if you add the word bank in any language to that, it comes with a lot of stature. Everybody wants to know, oh, so finance, Silicon Valley, that must mean something big. And so carrying around that business card, it actually made it very easy to go in and have a lot of conversations. Everybody wanted to know what it could do.
There are a lot of people who make a good living off of the name on their big, on their business card.
That's right.
Right,
yeah.
That happens in China.
That's right. Yeah. So I think that was a lot to do with the brand and kind of the promise that that brand brought. So getting your foot in the door with that brand is very easy to do. I think delivering is challenging because you are delivering a product in China that is not very well understood. I think a lot of people wanted to know, if you're a bank from Silicon Valley, what is it that you do? Mm-hmm. And when we said we make loans to early stage technology companies that don't have fixed assets, they don't have a real collateral, and they don't have any cash flows. In fact, they're losing money, and their most valuable asset is software code. In China, it was, you know, it was completely misunderstood in the beginning. And that's what we did in business development, is we spent a lot of time educating not just the entrepreneurs, but also the venture capital firms that were kind of homegrown mm-hmm. for them to understand what it does. So after 5 or 6 years, we did enough transactions and we did them successfully, and we helped enough companies get from point A to point B that today, I think a lot of people know and understand what it does, although the market is so huge and the opportunity is so vast that I think we're only a little bit of the way that we need to go.
So
Silicon Valley Bank today, absent Armand, Silicon Valley mm-hmm. Bank today has a huge task, but also a huge opportunity.
So tell us about you starting this new venture, you leaving Silicon Valley, and what kind of opportunity did you see, and why did you make that change?
Yeah, so it was about a year and a half ago where I was kind of looking at the marketplace and seeing what Silicon Valley Bank can do with its banking license. And I realized that while the opportunity is huge and what SVB is trying to do is very challenging, you've automatically created a gap. And that gap comes in transaction size, transaction structure, as well as complexity. And so we looked at the market and we saw all the kinds of requests and transactions that were coming across. And we saw that the bank had a lot of limits in what it can do. So what we decided to do was do what Silicon Valley Bank does very well in the US, which is it partners with venture debt funds. These are funds that are structured very much like equity capital funds. But what they do is they make loans into companies with warrants, which gives us the equity upside to be able to make a nice return for our investors. Mm-hmm. And so I began to talk to management at SVB and said that this is what we need to do in China if we're going to be successful. We need to partner the bank with a fund so that it can do more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even though the bank is regulated by the local regulators, the CBRC, together with the fund, we can do more. We can do larger transactions. We can do more complex transactions. And the bank was open to it and gave me the opportunity to consider it a partner in the market. So I can go around now and tell everybody Silicon Valley Bank is not just my alma mater, but it's also my partner. The team is from Silicon Valley Bank. So we have the former CEO of the bank as our co-GP, which is great. We also have another junior person who is coming from Silicon Valley Bank, a Taiwanese American who's worked with me in the past. We have a 3-person team. We're raising $50 million. To do this fund, and it's not without its own challenges, obviously. Mm-hmm. And the market's shifting. I think what you see in the market today, specifically the second half of 2015, is a slowdown from the first half of 2015 and 2014. Mm-hmm. And when I say slowdown, I mean in the equity market in China. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that entrepreneurs are going to look for alternative sources of capital. And in doing that, we're very happy to be that source in terms of debt finance. It gives us access to a lot more opportunities, but it also gives us kind of better pricing and better entry into the market. So we're very excited to be doing this at this time.
So would you say for an entrepreneur looking to come to China to look to fund their idea, to get some money, that the environment for them as an individual has become more lucrative? They have more choices.
Well, in the early stage, no. Mm-hmm. In the early stage, I think it gets tougher.
Really?
Right? Absent us, right?
Yeah.
Because in the early stage today, the market slowed down a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas 6 months ago, it might have been a lot better. Now it's slowed down a little bit. In the later stage, now there's more sources. Mm-hmm. So once the company's up and running, there's more sources of capital today with debt capital and other folks trying to get in.
Okay. I think this is a good time. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to thank one of our sponsors, and then we're going to come back on the other side and talk a little bit more about what you're going to be doing with Redline. We definitely want to get into your experiences of working with a lot of entrepreneurs and what you've seen here and start handing out a little bit of advice if we can. And you also talked about some things that were interesting at the China Accelerator 8x8, your presentation about kind of this global market slowdown and how you say that it's not necessarily that bad or that bad for everybody. So we'll get to that right after the break.
The China Startup Pulse is brought to you by
China Accelerator,
our sponsor.
Yeah, we really want to thank China Accelerator for sponsoring what we're doing, helping us, pay for all of our equipment and
to get to do this because we really love it and we love helping get the word out and information.
That's right.
To everybody else.
We're trying to help startups, and so is China Accelerator. So
yep.
they were the first accelerator in Asia. They're still really the only Western style mentorship driven seed accelerator in China. And if you're coming to China and you're thinking about doing anything around internet. China Accelerator in Shanghai
Absolutely.
Is a great place to do it.
Yeah.
Over 145 mentors, and we most of the guests we have on the show are mentors of the program, of the China Accelerator program, and it's just a great community, and really mm-hmm. big thanks to them for their support.
Yeah. If you want to find out more about China Accelerator, you can find it online at www.chinaaccelerator.com.
All right. Thanks. Thanks to China Accelerator.
Thanks, guys.
All right, we're back. I want to talk about a little bit about something that was interesting here. And before we dive right into the red line, staying with the banking part of it, internet banks.
Mm, yes.
They've come on here pretty strong in China, but not as strong as I thought they would. You know, a year ago, almost to the day, China handed out 5 internet banking licenses.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe, the big names got, you had the Baidu, you had the Alibaba, you had the Tencent. I think Minsheng was already there. They were the only one that maybe had them. Mm-hmm. You can correct me on that. I think somebody else got it. I don't know if it was something
I think Ping An has one.
Okay.
Dianrong.
Didn't Suning, no?
I don't know. I don't know that one. I know Ping An. Ping An's internet bank is called Lufax.
Oh, okay.
And then Dianrong, which is the link to Lending Club in the U.S.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I mean, for those who don't know, Baidu is the Google of China.
Yeah.
Alibaba is the eBay or Amazon. Of China. And then, of course, Tencent.
Is there
what
else?
Do you say? Yeah.
Tencent,
we used to describe them as the social, but now.
Is the everything else.
Yeah. And Dave. I mean, everybody's trying to. Yeah, I mean, for those out there who don't know, I mean, they just don't play that well together over here in China. We could talk about the fact that they're trying to be walled gardens and the rest of that. I mean, but we'll leave that for another show.
Episode. We can definitely talk about that.
But these internet banks, because from what I understand, there was nowhere to go. You couldn't go into a bank and get a small loan. And I remember when I think it was WeBank came out, their big opening ceremony was they lent something like 30,000-35,000 renminbi to a truck driver, to do something with, and this is what they cut the ribbon to open up the bank was.
That's nice. I like that. To a truck driver,
yeah,
something
but
nice.
There's a real problem here because banks wouldn't touch you. Am I correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
You are correct.
Yeah.
You are correct.
So what has the internet banking done to fix that?
So it's been a year since these are, do you know? I mean, sorry to put you on the spot if you're not the expert, but I mean, what's going on with these internet banks?
Yeah. I think the biggest challenge these internet banks have is that the pricing model, along with the competition that they're in, makes it very challenging on one hand. On the other hand, you have a lack of technology that's being applied or that's not being applied. And I'll just touch on both of those. On one hand, you have a lot of competitors. Today, anyone can start an internet bank. The three of us can walk out of here and go find some lenders and some borrowers and put them together on a website called Craigslist. It can happen overnight. And that's what's happening in the past year, is that a lot of people are starting this kind of P2P lending.
Mm-hmm.
And Chinese consumers are not very loyal to brands, I don't know, unless it's Apple or Starbucks. So they're all after the best price. If you're a borrower, you're trying to get the lowest rate. If you're a lender, you're trying to get the highest rate, which means that the middlemen, the P2P lenders, are the internet banks, are really, really getting squeezed at the margins.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're getting squeezed at the margins, the only thing you can really do is build volume. And if you want to build volume, you have to throw a bunch of dollars at marketing. And if you had, and that means you just have to raise more money, right? So I think that creates a huge challenge for most of the players out there. I think about 20% control 80% of the market, and even them, they're getting quite squeezed. Everyone wants the best price, no loyalty. On the other hand, there's a lot of folks that are trying to do this without technology. As I said, the three of us could do this walking out of here. We don't need any expertise to do this. Well, if you do it without technology, what you're doing is you're employing a lot of people, a lot of human bodies to do what's supposed to be an internet bank. Well, that really takes away from what an internet bank is supposed to be, right? Applying real technology. So of the top internet banks in China, very few of them are actually applying real technology behind being able to distribute or connect lenders and borrowers. So I think at the end of the day, it's going to be very interesting to see, one, how they all pan out over the next 12 to 24 months. If you use group buying as an example, I think it's a there's some parallels there. Mm-hmm. If you see what happened, I mean, about 2012, 2013, there was tons of group buying companies. And at the end of the day, only a couple survived. And even out of the couple that survived, I think they recently had some transactions in the M&A space. So they've kind of come together to try to reduce cost and reduce the friction and competition. I think you're going to see the same thing. With internet banks, what's really interesting is what the government's going to do. Because all the banks want to be internet and all the internet wants to be banks. So at the end of the day, right, one of these is going to win. And I think the internet companies have a better chance of becoming financial services organizations than banks. Banks in every country suck.
Yeah.
Right? And they suck at technology. In every country. There's no country that where the banks are doing great in technology. But internet companies, you know, finance is not that hard to figure out. It's not rocket science. That's why people like Alibaba and Baidu have gotten into the finance area. Because it's not hard to figure out that people want a good return. So if you create a good product and you put it on your app or your phone, and people are going to sign up for it. And then the last one is the consumer. So what's going to happen to the consumers when they're really invested into internet banking in China? Do they really understand the risks? You know, the I think it was the, is it the Alibaba or the Tencent Yuebao, right? Which is the investment product that gives you 7% on your money. Well, people don't ever ask the question, what's behind that money?
Yeah.
Where is that money going into? And why am I getting 7%? What is the risk for getting 7%? In the US, if someone offers you 7%, you're going to be like, well, what does that really mean? Where's my money going into? Here, people don't ask that question. They just put, because 7%, great. The bank gives me 3%. They give me 7%. I'm going to put my money in there.
Yeah. I think there's also a there's another thing about the just the difference in consumers between America and China. There's like, I think that China, when they think about, let's say there's a product. It has, you're giving a Chinese person versus an American a product, and it they get two chances to use it, and it fails one out of those two times. So it's going to work once, it's going to fail once. You give it to an American first, and they're going to look at it, and they're going to say, okay, well, it works, and the second time it's going to fail, and they go, oh, well, it's broken. Whoever made this did something wrong. It's not working. And one of the things, you give it to the same product, same kind of procedure for someone in China, they're going to look at it, and the first time it's going to work, they go, oh, that's great. The second time they're going to use it, it's not going to be, not going to work, it's going to fail. They're going to go, oh, I must have done something wrong. Oh, it must have been, I must have been holding it wrong. I must have been interacting with it wrong or something. It's it's still a great product. I'm still really happy because it definitely worked, but it just must have been something else. I'm still happy about it. And so I feel like that also relates into it. There's this level of consumer trust that the brand is, it's big. It's either Tencent or Alibaba. It's out there. It's big. Like, it wouldn't get pushed to market unless it was trustworthy, unless it had something good backing it. I don't need to ask them all those questions because I trust them.
And it's a very good point, because that creates another problem, which is that people actually believe that there are guarantees behind this. Meaning that if you buy an Alibaba financial product and it fails and you can't get your money back, that you can actually go to the government, or you can go to the steps of Alibaba in Hangzhou and say, where's my money? Right. And we all know that these are not backed by real assets. So that will create a problem if there is ever, say, a run on the bank of Alibaba, in a sense like that, because people do expect that these things are guaranteed.
They're not. I didn't know that.
They're definitely not guaranteed.
They're not guaranteed
at all. They're not guaranteed at all.
These are
investments. You can't provide 7% return, you know, guaranteed.
These are just,
there's no place in the world that does that.
And you can buy these on your phone?
You can buy it on your phone with one click.
Like a WeChat payment. Instant transfer. Oh, I just got
instant transfer of money.
Oh my God. Yeah. That's like,
it's like gambling.
It's too easy.
It's gambling. I really consider gambling. But again, you know, it fits for the market behavior. I mean, people here like to see a return, and they're willing to take a bet to get that return.
Yeah.
One other point on this, it's very liquid. Meaning you can put your money in and out very quickly. And liquid investments in China are highly popular.
Yes.
Give someone a seven-year product, they're not so interested because they're thinking about the next 3 to 6 months.
Really?
Give someone a 1 month or a very liquid product, and they're very interested in that because they can get their money in and out as soon as possible.
These are 1 month cycles, 2 month cycles.
This is the Yuebao product, I believe. I'm not 100% sure, but I believe you put your money in and out at will.
At will.
It's
and that's why you keep it in.
That's why it works very well here. I mean, you know, they're very much like you know, just in the way that you interact or customer service, customer loyalty, this kind of thing that just doesn't it's not widespread here. You know, if a vendor can take five renminbi from you today in lieu of potentially getting 50 renminbi from you tomorrow, they will definitely take the 5 renminbi today every time, and they just prefer that. There's no trust in anything long term here. I did just wanted to say, for those of you listening who aren't aware of what WeChat is, we should explain that it is our world over here in China.
It's the one platform to control them
all.
It
is. So it is the reason WhatsApp got a $19 billion valuation from Facebook, in my opinion. You know, it is Facebook. It is Twitter. It is Instagram. It is.
It's an app on your smartphone.
It's PayPal.
It's PayPal. I mean, it's Maps. It's everything. I mean, it is your one-stop shop. I mean, round the table, I spend at least, I would say, 20% of my day, my work day, the amount of, you know, doing business, I do it on WeChat. What would you say, Armin? Where are you?
Probably north of 20% because I also use it in Chinese, which means a lot of my investors and clients are automatically just using WeChat. In fact, a China Accelerator founder recently decided that she's going to send me her PowerPoint in WeChat. And I didn't know how am I going to download it and look at it somewhere outside my phone. And I had to actually take some steps to learn how to do that.
Yeah. I've been getting business files in WeChat as well.
Yeah. I've had folks negotiate an investment agreement with me on WeChat. Yeah,
it's business ready. People believe it's a good way to communicate.
It's also Slack, by the way. I want to add that in.
Oh, yeah. It's also Slack.
It's also Slack.
It is completely.
And Venmo.
And FaceTime. We should make a list, everything that WeChat is.
Anybody that I can get off of Skype that I had to do a Skype with and I can get them onto WeChat, I do.
Yeah. By the way, the new version now does group
conference calling.
Also, other caveat is they just did their WeChat user report, and they said that on average, the Chinese user spends 4 hours a day in the WeChat ecosystem.
In combined minutes.
Every day, 4 hours in the WeChat ecosystem.
Yeah. Well, what was the number on the novels? The amount of news and things that they're reading on it? I mean, people are reading like something like 10 novels a month in news on their phone. Anyway, just wanted to make sure that
we have an episode about WeChat.
We do. We did. Episode 2, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, you got to check out WeChat. I mean, it's incredible. I just want to make sure that we pointed out what it was because we mentioned it quite casually. And we've been told by some of you great users who are giving us some feedback saying, what the F is WeChat? So yeah, we might make sure that we let you know. Okay, great. So we should step away. I want to get into the red line. Is the future of brick and mortar banks in China dead? Could it be dead?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't think so. If that was a reality, I think it's still 15 to 20 years away because I believe that the average Chinese here still believes in the brick and mortar model. They still want to walk into a branch. And I don't think that's true for the U.S. either. I think in the U.S. we're 15 to 20 years away from losing the brick and mortar. Mm-hmm. You know, when Amazon first started in the U.S., people thought that the stores were going away. The stores are not going away. Mm-hmm. I think human nature still is to walk into something and touch something, even if you're going to buy it online. I think people will walk into branches of banks in both the U.S. and in China, and they'll still go online and make the transaction, but they still feel good about walking to branches. I'm not sure if our children or their children will do that. But for the near, 20 years, I think that's still going to be a reality.
Yeah. So how
By the way, that's just a personal opinion. There's no facts about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. No worries. No one's going to hold you to the stake.
I was going
to
say.
So I have another question. How has the advancements in lending and internet banking, all these things, helped the startup environment in China?
Zero?
Zero. I want to know.
I was
going to
say
why.
The same, actually. Yeah.
Zero.
I want to know. I want to know how.
So
like, how, why
startup,
hasn't it?
Startup lending.
Yeah, tell me.
It's still
about
a
that.
Lot like venture capital, And it should be, because it's a very risky nature.
Mm-hmm.
And it's low volume, high margin.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not ready for the internet. Mm-hmm. The internet players are focused on high volume, low margin. And that means either consumer or small businesses. Small businesses meaning the mom and pop noodle shop or a small manufacturer or of the like. And I think that's still high volume, low margin. Whereas what we do, startups, is very low volume. I mean, if you look at Silicon Valley Bank's addressable market, it's not huge. It's not huge. It's every startup that's been funded or well-funded by good venture capital firms. And if you look at that as an entity and you look at the number of entities in China, it's a small, tiny number, mm-hmm. right? So we, as lenders for startups, we still take a very venture capital, high-touch approach. Our average transaction cycle could be 90 to 180 days. If you're going to lend from the, if you're going to borrow, excuse me, from the internet, it should take you 24 to 48 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So to this day, none, and I don't expect it to in the near future. Although I do think that crowdfunding,
mm-hmm.
which is different than P2P lending, I think crowdfunding could be a platform for venture lending in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that, you know, we have the opportunity to be the pioneers of that.
Agreed. Okay, yeah, with that, I think we'll segue into one more break. Thank our second sponsor. We've already thanked China Accelerator for sponsoring our podcast. We now want to thank PeopleSquared. And then when we come back, we'll talk directly about Red Lion and a little bit more about that presentation that you gave that I alluded to. All right.
This episode is also brought to you by PeopleSquared.
What is PeopleSquared?
Huh? Exactly what I was about to ask you.
PeopleSquared is the WeWork of China. They are the group of co-working spaces. They've got a number of locations, 8 or 9 locations here in Shanghai. I know that now they're up in Beijing. Mm-hmm. They're doing stuff down in Shenzhen. They're just everywhere.
Yeah, and it's also a community. They bring together
That's
startups.
What makes them great.
Yeah, that's
makes
that's
them
the fantastic.
Whole key. I mean, there is a lot of co-working spaces in China, really, to be honest.
Oh, yeah.
And you will never be able to find them. And if you walk into them, it's kind of like walking into a ghost town.
Yeah.
And one of the big differences, and it's not like there's not a lot of startups looking for great spaces to do startups in, it's just their focus on community.
Yep.
You know, the fact that they're always bringing in
great people, networking,
investors.
Events.
Yeah. They promote within.
Yep.
I think they actually have a rule that if you don't engage and you're not part of the community events around the accelerator or the co-working space, that they might actually ask you to leave because it's such a big, important part of what makes them so great and so special.
Yeah.
So if you're coming to China,
absolutely,
and you need space and you want a soft land into a great space with a great ecosystem, mm-hmm. that's got this great vibe and this great community going on, PeopleSquared is really your only choice.
Yeah, absolutely. They're in Shanghai and Beijing right now. Are they?
Right.
Yeah. Perfect.
All right. Great. Thank you very much, PeopleSquared.
Thanks. Welcome back. So, Armin, tell us more about your firm, Red Lion Capital.
Absolutely. As I mentioned, the idea was that we would spin off from Silicon Valley Bank and start this fund that can help expand what Silicon Valley Bank is doing. We are a venture lending fund that startups that are Series A and later can approach apply for debt financing, what's typically called venture debt. And what that means is that if you have already received equity capital from a reputable firm, we are happy to provide financing on top of that so you can grow faster. We don't come in exchange or in lieu of equity. You don't raise venture debt because you can't get venture capital. It doesn't work that way. You first need to make sure to get venture capital because venture debt is an additive product. The main reason people come to us is because they want to delay the next round of equity, not because they can't get it, but because the longer they can delay that next round of equity, the higher that valuation could be if they're in a growth pattern. So let's take an average company whose valuation is tied to revenues, customers, users, partners, milestones, you name it. They know that the venture capital firms are knocking on their door saying they want to put more money into this company. But if they do it today versus 18 to 24 months away or even 12 months away, that growth will continue and that valuation will be higher and they're able to raise that next equity at a much better valuation, save dilution for the entrepreneur and the founders. Mm-hmm. The one question they always get is, well, why do VCs want this? Are you competing with the next round of VC? And the reality is that we're not. 99% of our referrals comes directly from the VC, meaning that this decision to take venture debt from a venture lender is made at the board meeting. And the way the conversation goes is that everybody wants to see the next valuation be higher. Even the current investors want to see the next round valuation be higher, even if they're going to be in a follow-on investor. Because as an existing investor, you still want to be able to mark up that investment and show your LPs that was a great valuation uptick from where you originally invested. So my job is to spend a lot of time with entrepreneurs and spend a lot of time with the venture capital world, and so that they understand what we do and how we could be helpful. As I mentioned, 9 out of 10 times the referral comes from the board or a board member or a venture capitalist that's a friend or partner of us. And they bring us into the situation, and we go and talk to the company, and we figure out how to be helpful. We usually take interest and fees like a normal lender, mm-hmm. but because a lot of times, almost all the time, banks are not interested in what we do, then we can get upside equity in terms of warrants in the company to make up for the risk that we take. And so the average venture loan can have a reasonable interest rate. We're not loan sharks. We're not in the 30% range. A reasonable interest rate with fees and a warrant to go along with it. We typically don't ask for personal guarantees, and we typically don't ask for a share pledge of founder shares because we don't believe in that. We believe in the long-term growth of the company and the opportunity that it brings.
Yeah. Sounds good, and it sounds right. Yeah. Which I appreciate.
Do you see a lot of early stage A or potential like companies for your product in China right now? Is that growing despite the slowdown that you were talking about?
Absolutely. When venture capital slows down and valuations go down, there are a lot of companies that have raised an A round, and this is what you're trying to get into next, right?
That's right.
There are a lot of companies that raise an A round.
Giving Ryan the evil eye.
Yeah, Ryan took your question. A lot of A round companies that may not be able to raise a Series B. A lot of B round companies that may not be able to raise a Series C, and so forth. And so obviously what that means is that they're going to look for alternative sources of funding, which venture lending can be one. What we tell VCs is, please don't send us your shit companies. If you've decided that you're no longer going to put money in this company, you've decided that you're going to let it die or continue to float, that's not where we want to come in, because we don't want to lose money. That's not what we're here for. Give us the company that is going to be the winner in your portfolio, and we're going to come in and we're going to make that a superstar by adding some debt capital to it.
Debt capital sounds so
juicy.
call it something else. You know, some hug capital, some...
Yeah, fuel.
Fuel, yeah. Some awesome...
Jet fuel.
Yeah, fuel capital.
We should have called ourselves Jet Fuel Ventures.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I know, to put it in perspective, I know that there's another company that we went through, and they were debating. They said, we need some money. You know, it was in the somewhere between 50 and 150, let's just say that. But they were like, we could raise now. We need money now. But, man, we're going to be in such a better position in 7 to 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
Really going to be in a great position mm-hmm. in 7 to 9 months. That's what we really... So then they said, well, let's do some bridge financing. Is this bridge financing?
Bridge financing in technical terms means that your next round valuation has been decided, term sheets are signed, and you're in documentation, but you really want money now versus in 30 days. Mm. It's actually very expensive financing because the lender can lose their money if their round falls apart.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be very expensive. What you're saying is actually venture debt.
Mm-hmm.
Although the problem with someone who's looking for $100,000 is that venture debt transaction costs can be anywhere between, especially if you're doing it in China, $15,000, $20,000. So it may not make sense at $100,000. We did a deal for a China Accelerator company that was total $500,000. It was one of our smaller deals. But
this might have been about 3 years ago.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And that company went on to get additional debt from Silicon Valley Bank at much higher amounts. So that transaction fee ended up split over multiple transactions, and it was worth it. So I would say that someone who's looking for $100,000 is still, I mean, that burn rate must be really small. So I would say that that is probably not the best candidate. And so for early stage companies, it may not make a whole lot of sense. But we look at all opportunities.
And what they ended up doing was a small round.
So what about a company that is doing well in a different place, not China? They're in their home nation. They're doing really well, and they want to expand. So they're looking. They've done their A series. They're growing pretty fast. But they know that if they could add China to their market, they could bridge and get that, that they could do much better. So would companies that don't exist in China yet be looking at you for an extra push?
Yeah, it's interesting. We have partners all over the world, and so we want to be in their home. You want your lender to be in your home country, just like you want your VC to be in your home country. You want to have that that connection. So if it's a UK-based company, I'll just refer that to our kind of UK partners. If it's a US-based company, I'll refer that to our US-based partners. But if the founders are going to move here, we had a company in Singapore that was going to do exactly that. They wanted China to be their new market. Singapore was kind of getting off the ground, but China was really the push. And so the whole team moved over to China from Singapore, and we ended up giving them a loan from our China office. Wow. So that could work.
So it has happened.
It has happened. Mm-hmm. It has happened. But again, if the founder is sitting in New York, I'll just call our kind of New York partner and get them talking.
Yeah, I mean, and I think as China Accelerator moves towards helping a lot of companies kind of build out China as their secondary or their third or fourth market expansion, which is where we're kind of positioning ourselves to be a lot recently, as well as helping the locals, you know, prepare to go global. That's an interesting option, you know, to come to you guys. They've raised before. They're just expanding, maybe don't have anybody on the ground to actually lend them money or to raise money from anybody on the ground. Potentially a viable alternative.
Yeah,
for sure.
Here's a question to both of you guys. So, what does it look like in terms of the roadmap between the future cooperation of or the ecosystem of these accelerators helping these companies get funding, start moving forward, and then companies like Redline who are funding them, helping them get more value and later in their rounds and things like that? Does the space in China look like it's getting more complex, more mature, or is there still room for other players, or are things getting grabbed up very quickly?
I was going to say, go ahead. I mean, there's a lot to be said about. We had an interesting session a couple of weeks ago with all the mentors from China Accelerator, and you know, Armin's been a long time mentor, now an expert in residence as well here, around just even like the predatory nature of VCs, and talking about terms and valuations and these kinds of things. But go ahead, Armin, it's you're the guest.
Yeah, in a hurricane, even pigs can fly. I always like to point that out, and I think in the past 3 years, there's been a hurricane in China and a lot of players. I mean, Chen, Li, and Fu calls themselves a venture capitalist now or angel investor. It's a Dick, Harry, and Joe in
yes,
English,
right? That's
right.
Yeah.
I just tried to localize that
Tom,
for
Dick,
you.
Tom, Dick, and Harry.
Tom, Dick, and Harry, right? Yeah. So I said Li, Chen, and Fu. There's a lot of noise in the market. Everybody wants access, right? You've got your accelerators, you've got your angel investors, you've got your seed investors, the lawyers, the VCs, the debt funds like us, right? The question is, in the long-term scenario, right? And this is not just China, by the way. This happens everywhere. Every market of venture capital ecosystem, this happens. What happens when there's a slowdown? What happens when people start losing money? Who stays? And who goes, right? One of the reasons why Silicon Valley Bank has been successful in the U.S. for so many years is that when there was the crash of 2000 or 2007, in those rough times, Silicon Valley Bank was always there. And so people knew that they're there through thick and thin. And so in good times, when the market floods, they maintain that kind of loyalty in that market. And I think the same thing is going to happen here. I think right now there's a lot of still hype in the marketplace, so everyone wants in and everyone wants access. Well, let's see what happens in a couple of years if there's a slowdown and who's going to come out the other side. And the people that are here the other side, we hope that they're able to build some loyalty on top of that and continue to be there. And I'm sure China Accelerator will be one of those.
Give us a little bit of the lay of the land in that, because, you know, there's a lot of talk and rhetoric in the news about slowdowns and what's going on. And so for those of maybe the ones outside China that are aware of what's happening, maybe they're experiencing this slowdown, in other places around the world. What's happening in China in this regard? And if you're doing a startup or thinking to come here, can you prepare yourself or plan for a potential slowdown by doing one of two things, like raising right now or preparing yourself or doing something with your company to prepare for winter is coming. You know, I think a lot of people are liking to say now. So winter coming?
Fill your left cheek with walnuts as much as you can so that you can survive the winter. So I spent a lot of time talking to venture capital firms and LPs and lawyers. And if you can triangulate what they're telling you, you get a sense of what's going on. 2014 was a massive year for venture capital in China. $14 billion. Some people have a different number, but it's huge either way you slice it. 2015, first half until June, same thing, even outpaced 2014. And then the stock market in China took a hit, 40-30% drop or whatever. The second half, we see the slowdown. So when I talk to my venture capital friends, what they're telling me is that they're going to slow down the investment pace. Number one reason, because they want to kind of go back and cultivate what they did for the past 18 months in that kind of hurricane. Number two is that a lot of these funds have now outspent themselves and they're not going to go back in the market and raise more money unless they can show what happened or what the results were of their funds that just invested those huge sums. Plus, the valuations have been so high that the expectations are so high that people want to see what is the result of that, you know, high valuation, high expectation. So what we're seeing is that the second half of 2015 and potentially the first half of 2016, you're going to see a marked slowdown in the number of deals and you're going to see a downtick in the valuations. I don't know how long this is going to last and I don't know how deep it's going to be. Mm-hmm. It could go into a deep, long winter or it could just be a bump along the road. For Red Lion, we're agnostic. We're in both situations, we do well. So it's not going to affect us as much as it is the entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. But either way, if it's a long winter or if it's a blip on the screen, there's a few things that entrepreneurs can do. It's not China related. It's globally if their market's going to have a slowdown. First and foremost, if you're talking to investors today and you have a term sheet in front of you, take that money off the table. Don't risk going into a downturn because you wanted to negotiate for another 1% in valuation or ownership share. That's just foolish. Mm-hmm. Take money off the table. We're definitely not in an upswing, right? We know that.
Take the money.
Take the money. Yes. Take the money. We know we're not in an upswing. We know that next month is not going to be better than today. So take the money off the table. Mm-hmm. That's number one. Number two, like in any sort of downturn, spend wisely. In great times, our pockets are a little fatter. My pockets got fatter, so we can spend a little bit more money on nice to haves, right? Yeah. A little bit nicer office space, 12 engineers instead of 10.
Yeah,
That one additional advertisement that we want to put on Google or Baidu.
The really nice chairs.
The really nice chairs. You know, the Harman chairs instead of the IKEA chairs. In times like this, you really got to try to save as much as you can. And tighten your belt a little bit. The last pro tip, this is the advanced feature, is it's time to hire the people that are getting laid off. Ooh. Because some companies are smart. They just lay off, the bottom 10% performers. Some companies aren't very smart. They just lay off across the board. Which means is if you're a three-person startup, a China Accelerator, and you're looking for that fourth founder, what better way than to get that from someone who's actually a little cash rich right now? Mm-hmm. I tell my cash rich friends, it's really a good time to go be a partner at China Accelerator because of your companies, because these guys can afford to take very little upfront cash and work for equity. Mm-hmm. So it's a really good time to go see who's laying off people in any market that you're in, if there's a downturn, And hire some people who are okay with taking a little bit less cash and a little bit more equity. Mm-hmm. So I would say it's a great time to hire some good people. Yeah. But again, you know, if you need 10 engineers, hire 9, not 12.
Yeah. And I think that's a good point because, you know, yes, they've got some cash. They got to pay to severance or whatever it was, you know, to kind of walk away. So they've got that. And they're also feeling like this is not a market that is great to be looking for a job right now. They're just going to have that sense because they were just recently kind of laid off or let go. Now, you don't want to prey on their devalued sense of worth at the current time. However,
you'd be giving them a greater sense of worth, going after them, wanting them to come join your company.
But yeah, you'd say, listen, I don't have a lot of money to give you, but I do have a place for you. You know, you can call home and this and that. But yeah, you're right. I mean, it's a great time to be talented.
I think that one of the worst motivators for people is money. I think that people are motivated by more than just money. They're motivated by their dreams, by what they want, by a challenge, by people around them that care about what they're doing. That you can go to somebody who used to get paid a lot of money and you can give them a really interesting problem to work on. You can give them an opportunity to make a difference. You can give them a lot of different kind of things and you can motivate them. You're smiling.
I'm
over
totally
there.
I'm totally snickering over it. Yes, Ryan is that guy. Ryan's that guy. Yeah, he's the softy.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
And I'll give you a hug later.
God, please don't.
No, but I think when you are looking at building your team as a startup, don't be afraid to go and ask people who you would think would be like, oh, no, there's no way that person would join me. Like you're saying, Armin, people that are getting, they're high value. They have a lot of experience, good performers. They're in a down market right now. They could be perfectly ready. More ready than somebody who's just finished school and doesn't really know where to go, but is really passionate about something. More ready to take on the challenges and better for your team in the long run.
Yeah. Ken Wilcox, my mentor and partner and former boss of CEO of Silicon Valley Bank, used to always say, there is the people that throw parties and the people that go to parties. And today in the market, the people that throw parties are the founders. And the people that go to parties are looking for founders, the people that throw parties. So if you're a founder in this market, you don't need to find a lot of people that throw parties, but you need to find a lot of people that go to parties. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what you're going to see if there's going to be some layoffs and if there's going to be people looking for jobs.
Any more pro tips before we wrap this one up?
Yeah.
You've done a lot of talks for us over the past how to approach a mentor. Here's some examples of some douchebags trying to get in touch with me on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
And, all these other things.
You know, that's what I love about the opportunity you give me, Todd. Todd says, come to China Accelerator. There's 250 people willing to listen to you and you can say anything you want. And I'm like, wow, I can say anything I want. I've always got things to say.
Okay, so for those looking to come to China,
okay,
they're, you know, you've been in China a long time.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, learning the language, and even still, you say you spend 5-6 years, you know, 6 days a week, hour and a half a day, and still, if you're going to do hardcore business in China, you still need a translator. I think that's crazy.
Yeah,
it really demoralized me, and I just quit learning Chinese at that point. So pro tips, yeah. I think for those that are looking to get into it.
I met a young entrepreneur here who's not in the program but should be. And he's building a wearable product, and he rides around Shanghai in a electric scooter, which for those who don't know, it's essentially free cost, right, of getting around Shanghai. He sleeps on a friend's couch, so he essentially has no rent. And unless I invite him out to lunch, he's going to be eating a ramen noodles for about 90 cents a day. Mm-hmm. Point being is it's a very cheap place to be if you want to do a startup and you need a base. Mm-hmm. Challenge is that if you're a foreigner, it's really hard to build for China unless you really have your feet on the ground and a finger on the pulse. Is this show called The Pulse?
Yeah.
China Startup Pulse.
I just brought it home. You see that?
I like that.
I just brought it home. God, having your finger on the pulse and understanding what what the Chinese are looking for is challenging, but it's a very, very good place to start a business because you can do it at a very, very low cost if you're willing to couch surf and ride an electric scooter around.
I agree. I have said this all the time. I mean, you know, again, it's why I love where China Accelerator is right now. So we're recording this podcast inside of, you know, the heart of China Accelerator, right in the middle, dab smack in the smack dab in the middle of all the operations here. You know what? Smack dab's fine.
Dab smack.
Stop laughing.
Dab smack.
And, you know, that's why you hear all some random sounds around us sometimes, because we really are in the thick of it. We're right in the middle of Jing'an. But you're absolutely right. Although Shanghai can be as expensive as any city in the world.
Yeah, you could choose that lifestyle. Yeah. You can choose the really expensive. It's
choose your own adventure.
Yep. Yeah, it's got the high ceiling, but it's got a much lower floor on how much you might want to spend as far as where you're going to stay, how much you're paying for rent. And you can do this downtown. I mean, we're a football field from Jing'an Temple, which is kind of the dead center of the old Shanghai.
Yeah,
park.
When I come to China Accelerate, I go to the Ritz-Carlton to use the bathroom.
I know. Yeah, that's crazy, right? It's so true. It's so true. And it's great. And you can really get away. You can get the cheapest meals. You can get around for cheap. And you can do things, you know, fast. You can get around efficiently. Even the bus system is amazing because nobody takes a bus anymore. And there's always seats on the bus. It's amazing. You know, I mean, you can really do things on the cheap. Really. And there is just a floor. If you're going to go to New York and you want to go to Silicon Alley and you want to do a startup and you want to do it in New York, there is an absolute minimum that is extremely high that you are going to spend to survive mm-hmm. in New York. Mm-hmm. It's just there. And Shanghai has a way lower floor.
Yeah.
And then you've just got the whole internet ecosystem and you know,
I've always
which
said
we're
this,
in here.
The kind of lifestyle that you can still live in that really low level, like you still feel good. You still feel like your
standard of living is still
so
quite high.
Yeah, you're still okay.
You can
know?
Really pretend, and nobody judges you. Actually,
no, either God, nobody judges you.
You know, eating street meat and getting those 90-cent ramen noodles is actually pretty cool. You know, it's you're doing it for the experience.
That's true.
Not because you have to. You can always go with that. It's great. I mean, you know, it is. It's a fantastic place. It's so the wild, wild west out here.
Yeah.
And I think we're all having a hell of a lot of fun being in startups here in China.
Yeah. Has anyone ever, Armin, like questioned your dedication towards doing this in China? Have they ever put you against the wall? And
they do. And then I start speaking in Chinese and they back off.
Ah.
You know, in China, the first thing you learn is to be modest.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, 5 years ago, if someone told me your Chinese is really good, I'd be like, yeah, that's right.
You know, yeah, I'm the best.
Yeah.
I learned one phrase.
But once you learn Chinese and people say, your Chinese is so good, you're like, oh, you know, it's by luck. Or just a little bit.
Yeah.
Right?
So just a little bit.
So my I've become much more modest also about my Chinese. But but in the investment world, because I'm raising money for my fund, is people do actually put me on the spot, and then I start speaking to them in Chinese, and I do the fund pitch in Chinese, and then they're like, okay, I get it, fine, and then we kind of move on. So it's a little bit of a test.
That's good. Okay. Well, thank you very, very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
That was
awesome.
Glad
to be here.
Yeah. All right. So on behalf of Ryan, co-host, say bye, Ryan.
Bye, Ryan.
I knew he was going to do that. From myself, Todd Emily, and co-host, and thank you very much for Armin from Redline Ventures.
Great talk. Thank you.
Redline Capital.
Redline Capital.
Awesome. All right.
Oh, yeah. Also, before we go, can you please tell us how our listeners can get a hold of you, how they can contact you, find about Redline Capital, all these kind of things.
Email azand@redlion-capital.com.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hey, before we go, real quick, we would love to hear from you, the listener. So please contact us at team@ChinaStartupPulse. We'd love to give your questions a voice on the episodes, be able to ask our guests, and give you guys more of a part to play in this, because this is for you. So please contact us at team@ChinaStartupPulse.com, tweet at us @ChinaStartupPulse, or find us on Weibo, which is the Chinese Twitter, @ChinaStartupPulse. Thanks.